Lindsay Weaver was wearing the same clothes when Jasper King picked her up in the fall of 1949. In a small ceremony, they were married at the main altar of St. John the Baptist, and Father Maxwell Sadler performed the ceremony with all the panache for which he had become so famous in the Diocese of Charleston. Stephen Dedalus King was born 10 months later in 1950, and I was born in 1951. Jasper's patience had earned him, at last, the love of his life.
"The wind is picking up, Leo," Father said. "Let's get back to the marina."
We reeled in our lines. I took care of the gear as my father cranked the boat, and we made our way back up the river, the small motor strumming against the tide. Trailing my hand in the warm salt water, I tried to think of the strangeness of time when I was not a part of it. How unimaginable a world denied the coiled, itchy presence of Leo King. Yet my father had permitted my entry into a landscape where mothers were cloistered and celibate, and fathers were handed back to lives of solitude, even bitterness. A week ago, I would have written out my autobiography and not even come close to approaching its central truth. If the beginning of knowledge is when you discover more gargoyles than realities in your past, then my father and I had spent a long and fruitful night together on the Ashley River. At the marina, we tied up our boat and gathered our gear, treated our rods and reels properly, and cleaned the fish we had caught with dispatch and expertise. Father made a fetish out of performing tasks the correct way. There was an efficiency and economy of his motions that I always found a pleasure to watch and a pain to mimic. When we walked across Lockwood Boulevard and returned to the house, I walked to my mother's bedroom and knocked on the door as my father stacked the fish in the freezer. Not unbelievably, she was reading Ulysses. "Did you catch any fish?" she asked, laying the dog-eared book on her bedside table. "It was a good night," I said, going in and lying down beside her. I am not an affectionate boy by nature, and this was a rare gesture for me. She put her arm around me, and I nestled my face against her shoulder, a rarity for a woman not famous for her affectionate nature either. "Thanks for leaving the convent, Mother," I said. "You did a hard thing." She did not say anything for a moment, then asked, "Why do you say that?" "Because I know you. I bet you were happy in the convent. You felt safe there." "I wanted to be a wife. I longed to be a mother. I wanted it all, or thought I did." "You didn't know about things like Steve," I said. "I never wanted to know about things like Steve. We almost lost you because of Steve. Your father and I almost lost each other." My father came into the room and could not hide his happiness in finding me in my mother's arms. "I'll leave you two alone." "I was just going to bed," I said, jumping up. "Good night, Leo," Mother said. My father grabbed me and kissed me and said, "Good night, sweet pea." "Night, Father." Smiling, I couldn't help myself. "Good night, Sister Mary Noberta." I escaped the room before the copy of Ulysses, flung at my head, hit my parents' door as I ran laughing to my room. Chapter 6. Dear Old Dad. I lay in the darkness of the room, going over the events of the past week, amazed at their variety and complexity. The forces I had encountered during the week began to materialize as I set my clock for 4:30 a.m. In the country of dreams, I began my nightly voyage. Steve was there, as he always was. I got to tell him about the orphans, the twins across the street, the black football coach and his sullen son, the lunch at the yacht club, the fishing trip, and our mother's convent days. I woke when I heard screaming and crying and my father at my door, turning on the light.
Get up, Leo. There's trouble across the street.
I put on my pants and a t-shirt and Darksiders. I reached for my glasses and rushed out of my room and encountered a sobbing Sheba Poe, her dazed brother, and their half-drunken mother. In the living room, my mother opened a gun cabinet, handed my father his shotgun, and then me mine, the one I had inherited from her father. Goofy from the lack of sleep, my father slipped shells into the chamber of his weapon. I caught the box of shells Mother threw my way one-handed and was loading as my father said, "Someone's breaking into the Poe's house."
"We came here because we didn't have anybody else," Trevor Poe said, his voice despairing.
"He's found us again, Mama,"
Sheba screamed at her mother.
"He always finds us," she muttered half-coherently.
My mother in her nightgown was running for the telephone to call the police as father and I raced out of the house in darkness. There were times I hated being Southern, other times I reveled in it, and this was one of the latter. Since my parents had wanted me skilled in the ways of the woods and streams, I could work a shotgun the way a majorette handled a baton. My gun was a comfort as I followed my father and we circled the Poe's house, watching for movement and listening for sound. We found no signs of forced entry. We made our way through old growths of azalea and camellia bushes, then came to the front door as sirens bloomed overhead all throughout the city. My mother had not just called the cops, but the chief of police, whose daughters she taught. It was my father who saw the odd, grotesque sign painted on the front door, a smiley face painted in a large, scrawling hand, seemingly in blood. It had a single tear coming out of its left eye. My father got out a handkerchief and removed a small drop of it and put it to his nose.
"Fingernail polish," he said.
The cop cars hit the yard like landing craft, and officers spread all over the house and yard. Father grabbed my shotgun and whispered,
"You're still on probation, son."
"Forgot," I whispered back. Neighbors began to drift out on their first and second story piazzas, sleep dazed and curious. One police car had parked in front of our house, and I saw a policeman interviewing Trevor and Sheba and their mother. Belle Faircloth walked down the length of the street and reported seeing a stranger in a white car parked near Colonial Lake for two straight nights. The man was a chain smoker and had blondish hair, but she could provide no other physical description. A basement window had been broken, and the Poe's house entered beneath an untrimmed hedge. For more than 3 hours, the police scoured the house for clues or explanations, but they could find nothing moved or disturbed or stolen. Only the grotesque smiley face painted on the front door merited their attention. When the police left, my father and I returned home exhausted by the emotional night we had shared. Mother poured a shot of bourbon for her and my father and made a cup of hot chocolate for me. As we sat at the kitchen table whispering about the events of the night, my mother motioned upstairs and said she had put the Poe family to bed in the extra rooms my father had once rented out.
"Something terrible has happened to that family," she said quietly. "Something traumatic. They think someone came to that house to kill them."
"Not likely," my father said. "It might be a random break-in."
"Leo," mother said, "be nice to these kids. Be as nice as you can, but don't let them into your heart. You don't know how mean the world can be. You're so innocent, you don't know the dangers."
"Were you scared tonight, Leo?" father asked as I finished my hot chocolate.
"Terrified."
I stood up to return to bed.
"You didn't show it," mother said.
"That's because my father was with me."
It was just after 3 when I went back to bed and the neighborhood was quiet again. Sleep came easily. I had traveled far into a dream when I felt a girl's lips touch mine and I saw a naked Sheba Poe move into bed beside me. I had never been on a date or alone with a girl in a car, Yet here I found myself naked with the most beautiful girl I had ever seen, her hands moving up and down my body. Slowly, she brought my lips to her breasts. Then she took my hand and placed it inside her, and I learned how a woman could smell like earth, that her wetness felt like a place where fire could be born and brought to sublime life. Her tongue went down my throat and my chest, and she taught me in minutes all the places a tongue could go, all the places I had ever dreamed a tongue could go. When I entered her, I did it with her direction. I had never imagined the pleasure one body could derive from another. On top of me, she rose and pitched like a small, well-made boat in a storm-tossed river, as her hair came over her shoulders in soft, hot waves. She kept thanking me in a throaty whisper. When she came to me, I was dreaming. Then she pulled me into a life that was far greater and more sublime than any dream could be. After I came inside her, with her hand over my mouth to keep me from screaming, she slid out of my bed and disappeared into the night. Wordlessly, I lay awake, intoxicated by the life I was starting to live. As the sun rose out of the east, I thought of nothing but Sheba. Later that morning, I thought of her face with every copy of the News and Courier I threw onto the porches of Charleston. It would be years before I learned that my mother had witnessed Sheba Poe's withdrawal from my room that night. And my mother was not the only one. On Sunday evenings, my parents made a domestic tradition of sitting on the screened porch off their bedroom to watch the sunset over Long Lake and the Ashley River. Though they could be steely-edged and ruminant to a fault about the life of the mind, I found them both loopy and unapologetic about their own sappy romanticism when it came to their love for each other. Whenever they put on their Johnny Mathis or Andy Williams albums after dinner on Sunday, it was time for me to skedaddle to the comforting solitude of my room. It caused me a high level of anguish to know that my parents took pleasure in each other's bodies long before I knew anything of my mother's career path as a nun. After my single night with Sheba, it seemed like an abomination. Because of the Catholic Church, I would always feel paroxysms of guilt at any thought of sex, peckers, vaginas, intercourse, and the whole shebang. The teachings of the Roman Catholic Church would cover my soul like a condom for the rest of my life. Already, I could feel nothing but guilt for luxuriating in the pleasures of Sheba Poe's heaven-sent body, even as I wrestled with a great desire to see her again and tell her honestly, sincerely, and from the very core of my being that I loved her. It was an essential truth that I had been too thunderstruck to tell her that night, one that now shouted to be told. Loving her would square the guilt, ease my conscience, and go a long way in that futile Catholic exercise of making things right. My guilt seemed to have been contagious, as my parents called me out to the porch that morning soon after they were seated, their faces unusually serious and distressed. Facing me, Mother said, "We're worried about you, Leo. We think the Poe twins are in trouble. Your father and I are concerned about the whole situation." I turned to my father, who was usually the voice of reason, but even he was thoughtful. "The break-in at their house the other night, it doesn't add up. Except for the broken window, the police found no sign of forced entry," he explained. "There were no footprints around the house except for yours and mine, and the mother has been so drunk they can't get a signed statement. Even the twins are vague. And that smiley face at the door, it was fingernail polish. They found the same shade in both the mother's room and Sheba's." He paused then till Mother prodded, "You're not telling him everything, Jasper." "They found a bottle of the same fingernail polish in Trevor's room," Father added. "It seems he paints his toenails." I listened with a rising fear and a wholly selfish desire to defend Sheba. "They're nice kids," I argued. "They've had a hard life."
"You don't know what a nice kid is, Leo."
The sternness of my mother's voice irritated me.
"You've never had a friend."
I stood up and began to pace the porch, like a lawyer at the bar defending a client.
"That's not true. I had Steve, and I'll never have a better friend. I've made lots of friends in the past couple of years. Because of the drug thing, none of them are my age. That's my fault, and I'm not blaming anybody but myself. But the people I meet every day, the ones on my paper route, Harrington Cannon, my shrink, they all like me. The orphans and the twins don't know about the cocaine, but I can tell they want to be friends with me. So does the coach's son, Ike, now that we're getting to know each other. You're wrong to say that I have no friends. I spent my whole life lonely, but I've got some friends now. I plan to keep them. My whole life I plan to keep them and love them as long as they love me. I'll even love them if they quit loving me."
"That's our point," Mother said. "We're afraid the orphans and the Poe kids will use you."
"They won't," I said. "They need me. They need my help, just like those rich kids who got busted for drugs. Just like Coach Jefferson and Ike. I don't mind being needed. I don't even mind being used," I said, feeling a small strength that I'd picked up from Sheba, an unaccustomed boldness. "I'm sick of being lonely. I never mean to be lonely again."
I turned at that and bolted off the porch and back into the house, half jogging to my room. Though I was close to tears, I fought them off and became resolute instead. I reached to my bedside table and pulled out a rosary, blessed by the Pope, that Monsignor Max had given me on the day of my first communion. I tried to pray, but all the words turned to dust for me. Going to my closet, I retrieved my collection of Topps baseball cards. I kept my priceless card of Ted Williams on the top of one of the piles in the box, while Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, and Mickey Mantle crowned the other three. The box also contained the only photograph I had of my brother, Steve, and me. After his suicide, all photographs of my brother disappeared, as though his extraordinary light had not once illuminated the spirit of our household. As I lifted the photograph out, I noticed how it seemed to grow more fragile with the passing of time. But there I was in the snow-white suit of my first communion finery, with my brother's arm draped around me in a fierce, protective gesture. When my prayers rang truest to me now was when I prayed to Steve. Since his death, I had come to think of him as some fearless, irrepressible angel who watched over me, part Rottweiler, part guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and part seer, who would one day unlock the mystery of both our lives. In my worst moments, I could pray to Steve and not to the God who had stolen my brother and left me to face a terrifying world without my greatest ally by my side. In the great timepiece that was my life, my dance card was filled up every hour, my routine as set as a well-made cake. I awoke when my alarm went off the next morning and performed my morning toilet in ritual and darkness, then pedaled my bicycle down toward Colonial Lake and watched as Eugene Haverford's News and Courier truck pulled up to our appointed corner and four bundles of newspapers were heaved to the sidewalk. His cigar smoke was the first proof of my being alive each morning. That and the blood surging through my thighs and the warm air, thick as marmalade, and the first traffic sliding down Rutledge Avenue. Paper route, daily mass, breakfast at Cleo's, five new vocabulary words. My life was over-encumbered by habit. As I took my wire cutters and freed my stacks, I breathed in the odor of fresh ink and could smell the richness of the shallow tidal broth thrown off by Colonial Lake. I worked fast to fold my papers as tight as furled flags. Inside the truck, I heard Mr. Haverford cuss the president, Mayor Gilliard, Chief of Police John Conroy, and the Atlanta Braves. Not a morning went by when Mr. Haverford did not cuss with inflammatory gusto all the major and minor players who appeared for his court of disapproval in the morning paper. Off I went into the deep Charleston darkness, flinging the news of the world to the people of my route. Still, I thought of little but Sheba Poe and the night she came to my room. Crossing Broad Street on the fly, I took a left on Trad and did not work up a real sweat until I hit Legree Street. I would be back to some of these houses this very evening to collect for the delivery of next month's newspaper. I would learn the gossip and secrets and off-kilter and off-centered and off-putting history of my city. I was bound in a deep connection of appreciation and community to every reporter, editor, typesetter, secretary, ads man, publisher, columnist, and delivery man who worked in producing the News and Courier every day. By trying my destiny with this newspaper, I had given myself permission to pursue a career I hoped to find deeply satisfying. In a complete reverie, thinking of Sheba, I steered through the streets and could hear the mansions and the turned-in row houses whisper their stories to me. Toward the end of my route, I turned up Stoll's Alley so I could do the south end of Church Street. In my life already, I had fallen in love with shortcuts, alleyways, secret passageways, and cut-through easements like Stoll's Alley and Longitude Lane. Often I came to Stoll's Alley because of its mystery and inwardness. Its narrowness was like a form of perversity or flawed design, making it my favorite getaway in the city. The sun had not yet fully risen, and it was as dark as a confessional booth as I made my way with caution. A large man stepped suddenly out of a doorway, surprising me by blocking the lane. Then he shocked me by almost knocking me out with his fist. The quickness of it, the brutality, and the fact that I knew an ambush had occurred frightened me to the point of paralysis. His strength awed me. His quickness and complete mastery of the attack took me a moment to comprehend. When I had recovered enough to scream, his hand covered my mouth, a hand that felt like a first baseman's mitt. Then I felt a knife at my throat, and not the fun kind of knife that kids throw at trees. For a minute, he satisfied himself with the tactical accomplishment of his bold assault. As my eyes adjusted to the dark, I could see he wore a cheap Halloween mask with the eye holes cut out larger. The mask was black, and I could smell spray paint. Then he whispered to me, "Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed." No words any stranger could utter would cause me such surprise and terror. Because of those words, I felt certain the man was going to butcher me in that alley. No one without the most intimate, diabolical knowledge of my past would know the indescribable impact those words would have on me at such a moment. I was most likely the only rising senior in the American South who realized that the man had just uttered, in a voice filled with mockery and grotesque insider knowledge, the first line of Ulysses. "So, Leo, my boy, you and your parents love to go to church every morning. Isn't that nice? So goody-goody. So pious. So true to Roman Catholic doctrine." My mind sped up, and I thought a Klansman with a college degree had tracked me down. His knife played across my jugular vein. His breath was fresh, and his voice polished as I smelled a trace of Listerine as well as the scent of English leather aftershave. "River Run, Leo," the man whispered, taunting me with the first word in Joyce's silly-ass novel Finnegan's Wake. "I could cut your mother's throat, Leo," he added. "She's alone in her office a lot. Or your father's. That's a nice little lab he has set up in the house. Or your new friend, that nigger Jefferson you work out with every morning.
You choose, Leo. Which one? Too paralyzed to speak, I was having difficulty breathing when he continued. Or how about you, Leo? Right here in this alley. I could end your life now and no one, not even you, would know why you were killed. Or let's get creative. Suppose I dig up the bones of your brother and you wake up one morning sleeping next to his bones. I like that one, Leo. You like it? No? I didn't think you would. Let's make a deal. I watched you fucking your new neighbor the other night. Let's not have that happen again. Is that a deal, Leo? I nodded my head. Tell anyone about what happened here, and I kill your mom and dad. I'll take my time and do it slow. Then I'll come for you. Now, hold still, Leo. There was a sudden click of a flashlight, blinding me, and the knife went away. I heard it moan back into its sheath. Then a greater fear than I had yet felt overwhelmed me as I smelled the distinctive odor of fingernail polish and felt the man painting something on my forehead. He took his time. When he was finished, he said, "Don't move for 5 minutes. Promise me, Leo. Say, like Molly Bloom, 'Yes,' I said, 'yes, I will, yes.'"
"Yes," I said, "yes, I will, yes," I said, strangling on my own black terror as the man rose and walked calmly down Stoll's alley, leaving me with only the last line of Ulysses to keep me company. For more than 5 minutes, I waited. Not until it was daylight did I move and walk my bike to Church Street. Moving toward a Mercedes-Benz parked on the street, I studied my face in the rearview mirror. My left eye was red, but it probably wouldn't blacken or close. The left lens of my glasses was shattered. But the disturbing sign was the one I was expecting. There on my forehead was the death's head stigmata of the smiley face, with the single exaggerated tear beneath the left eye. With one of my remaining newspapers and my fingernails, I scraped off the disfigured painting on my head, then walked into a customer's spacious garden, turned on the spigot, and washed my face. Because of the threats made by the attacker, I could not tell anyone what had happened. To explain my broken glasses, I would have to fabricate an accident on my bike. I wondered what blighted, unspeakable world I had entered by accident. My idea to entertain the twins after the frightening night they had been through was spontaneous and full of holes, but my father agreed to help me form a coherent plan. I called him from the Pose house the day after my secret attack in the alley and detected a quaver in his voice when I asked for his help. It was a quaver that nearly broke my heart, for in it I could hear his eagerness to help, his earnest father's hope that even the slightest sense of happiness might be jaywalking across the street, heading in his only son's direction. He grasped my plan easily and promised to have everything ready. "Can I borrow your convertible, Father? The 57 Chevy?" I knew I was asking a huge favor. "I'll take good care of it, I promise." "Didn't I tell you? I don't own that car anymore, son. I got rid of it." "When?" I was outraged. I had thought my old man would have sold my mother and me into slavery before letting his favorite car out of his sight. "Who'd you sell it to?" "I didn't sell it to anyone. That car's too precious to sell. I'm giving it to you, son. I was always going to give it to you, but I have to wait until you get off restriction. You can borrow it. It'll be washed and ready to run when you get home." I hung up without saying goodbye. I could not utter a word, not a single word, not at that time, not to anyone on earth. My father's approach to the world was narrow-gauged and shot through with modesty and diffidence.
He lacked flashiness, boldness, and flair. Each day he approached as a formula he would study with assiduousness and solve with aplomb. His affection for swank, fast cars was an oddity for him, the one misfit sentence in a textbook of boilerplate scientific prose. Never had he purchased a brand new car off the lot, but waited with his granite-like patience until a car had aged enough to fall into the price range of a high school science teacher. He was now driving a black 56 Thunderbird convertible that he had pronounced a classic the moment he laid eyes on it, when it made its debut on the Charleston streets, now more than a decade earlier. When Sheba and Trevor appeared in our yard, I was shy around Sheba. Trevor's light-hearted presence, however, made being with her a little less formidable. My father had apparently put aside his distrust of them and seemed happy to entertain the only two people in town who had not heard the 25 canned jokes he carried in his measly repertoire. He chatted amiably with them while I ran to put on my bathing suit, a Citadel T-shirt, and an Atlanta Braves baseball cap Father had bought me when we caught a doubleheader the summer before. When I came to the garage door, Father threw me the keys high in the air. I made the imaginary gesture of removing a catcher's mask, adjusted my glasses, and made the catch near my mother's prized camellia bushes. The twins cheered. My father bowed, then loaded a large inner tube into the back seat and instructed Trevor to hold on to it tightly as the convertible sped its way toward James Island. "Does Mr. Ferguson know we're coming to his plantation?" I asked him. "He does, and he knows why you're coming. I told him we'd pick up the Chevy tomorrow." "Make sure you meet us when we make it to the Ashley," I said. "I called Jimmy Wiggins at the marina. He's lending me his Boston whaler. I'll be doing a little fishing when you come out of the creek."
"You fishing for whales?" Sheba asked.
"No, sweetie, that's just the name of the boat." When I started the car, I had one great worry, but I had a plan for how to deal with it. I'd still told no one about the man in the alley, concocting a bike wreck to explain my bruised face. Since my attacker had taken on an aura of omnipotence and mystery, I worried about him following us, trailing after us like a mako shark following the scent of a wounded grouper through the grottos of a coral reef. But if this man pursued us on this day, he would have to know the streets of Charleston as well as I did. I was both a native of the city and a paperboy to boot, so a map had imprinted itself on my brain. I gunned the car down Lockwood Boulevard, then made a sharp right and shot through the streets beside the city's hospital, before swinging left on Ashley Boulevard, checking my rearview mirror as I turned sharply down each street. By the time I reached the Savannah Highway, I was certain we were not being followed, and I relaxed and joined the twins in their animated conversation as I turned south, psycho-free and happy to be a teenage boy at long last. I was lightheaded as I listened to the twins talk nonsense. Trevor leaned between us from the back seat. When he felt me relax, he invited me into their country of delicious, ridiculous banter. In the life I had lived, the free-flowing chatter of teenagers was unfamiliar. I found it joyous and liberating as we made our way across the Ashley River Bridge and headed out toward Folly Beach Road.
"Leo, it's my thought that Sheba should marry Elvis Presley next year."
"Isn't Elvis married?" I asked.
"A mere inconvenience. One glimpse of Sheba and Elvis would be sprinting toward the nearest divorce court. I've never met the man who could put up the slightest resistance to my sister's pagan charms, except for a man like me, of course. You know what I mean, Leo? Surely you know that I'm drawn to other compass points."
"Compass points?" I asked. Though I was desperate to be sophisticated, I lacked the foggiest notion of what he was talking about.
"Leo is a pure innocent," Sheba said. "You talk good, but you never know what you're talking about. And I disagree about Elvis. I don't see myself as a homebreaker, more like a nurse or a goddess."
"Ah," Trevor said, "she lays out her life in all its simplicity."
"I was thinking about marrying Paul McCartney. I can tell by his eyes that he's a soulmate.
Through him, I could jumpstart my acting career, play Juliet on the London stage, and meet the Queen of England. I'd love to meet the Queen. I sense her loneliness, and it's obvious that Prince Philip was a marriage of convenience, not of passion. I could keep her confidence while guiding Paul into making the right career moves.
I live for beauty,
Trevor said, apropos of nothing.
I will always go where beauty leads me.
I admire beauty, Sheba answered him, but art is what drives me. I want to be the leading actress of my time. I'd like to marry 3 or 4 of the most fascinating men in my era. But I want to make the whole world laugh and cry and be happy to be alive because my acting has touched them so deeply.
Well spoken, Trevor said. He turned to me and asked, What are your grandest ambitions, Leo? Hold nothing back. You and your father took up arms to protect us the other night, so you've become heroic in our eyes.
Tongue-tied and uncomfortable, I found myself inadequate to utter a word to these otherworldly twins. My dream of being with Sheba again one night was beginning to seem like the most absurd thing on earth. Should I tell them that I planned to wed Sophia Loren or become Secretary General of the United States, or take my vows and become the first American pope? My mind raced as we sped out on James Island, and I thought about some burning desire to be an astronaut, to study the mating habits of blue whales, to convert all of China to Roman Catholicism. All of these half-baked lies clustered around my tongue when I finally said, I'm thinking about being a journalism major in college.
He can write about us, Sheba,
Trevor said, his voice animated. He can spread our fame far and wide.
We'll give him scoops, she said. That's what a journalist needs more than anything, scoops.
At that moment, I had entered the whimsical, make-believe world of 2 kids whose lives would have proven all but unbearable if they had not set their imaginations free. It was a world where all the rules of civilized life had been smashed into shards and remade. Though I had never been to the Secessionville plantation, my father had given me precise directions, and I easily found the dirt road that brought us within sight of the mythic plantation. It was set on high ground, presiding over a vast acreage of marshlands that stretched for miles, the length and breadth of James Island Creek and the Folly River. Mr. Ferguson waved from the porch and gave us a thumbs-up sign. His pretty wife called down to see if we needed anything before we began our adventure. Trevor's bathing suit was so skimpy, it looked as though it were made by sewing 2 yarmulkes together.
It's European, he explained.
Sheba's bathing suit was a flesh-colored bikini, revealing enough to make me believe she could have her pick between Elvis and Paul McCartney, had either been lucky enough to join us that day.
Do you like my bathing suit, Leo? She asked.
What bathing suit? I answered, and both twins laughed. For the first time in my life, I set foot on the floating dock where my parents had fallen in love well over 30 years before. Since my father had revealed the story of their courtship, I started planning to make this watery trip alone. But I wanted to share it with 2 new friends, one of whom had pocketed away my virginity forever. I threw the inner tube into the retreating tide. It was the exact hour that the moon had issued the recall papers to all the waters of the marsh. As we stepped onto the dock, the tides turned exactly as I had planned it. We dove into the warm, sweet waters and came up to the inner tube laughing. Then began our long, slow-motion float out toward the Atlantic, which in its immensity and silence waited for all things. In the summertime, the salt water that floods the creeks and bays and coves of South Carolina is warm and sun-shod and silken to the touch. It did not hurt or shock to enter the water, but soothed and washed away the frazzled nerves of our runaway week. The creek was dark with the nutrients gathered in the great salt marsh. You could not see your hand if you opened your eyes underwater. We were swimming in a part of the Atlantic that the state of South Carolina had borrowed for a while. Now the tide was hurtling back, drawing the essence of its marshes, the blue crabs lying in wait for stragglers who would soon be prey. As the tide receded, the oysters would be locked tight, retaining a shot glass full of seawater that would hold them until the next full tide. The flounders hidden in the mud flats. The mullets flashing in quicksilver seagrass. The small sharks nosing around for carrion. The blue herons, straight-legged and heraldic in their motionless hunt. The snowy egrets, the only creatures in the low country whose name invoked winter, staring at the shallows for the quick run of minnows. I let the twins take it all in, and we remained wordless for the first 100 yards, remarkable only in our stillness and the rightness of the moment. Finally, I heard Trevor ask his sister,
"Is this it?" "Close. Very close. I can't be sure yet." "You're right. We'll have to see how it ends." "You could cut your foot on a broken beer bottle," she said. "Develop a case of tetanus, then die. Worse than dying, no one knows you here. There wouldn't be a soul at your funeral."
"I want thousands at my funeral, Sheba. That is a must."
"No tetanus, then."
Sheba looked toward Sullivan's Island and then back to the white chessboard of the city. The marsh held the deepest green of summer, the green of vestments, chameleons, or rainforests. The spartina grass threw off a bright, show-offy green that could change its aura when a cloud passed between the sun and the creek, invoking jade or olive oil in the ever-shifting light. Its green was infinite in the moment we found marshes, alive in our newfound friendship.
"This could be it, Trevor,"
Sheba said as we became part of the tide, the tube spinning in slow circles.
"What are you two talking about?" I asked. "No fair keeping secrets."
Both twins laughed, then Sheba explained.
"You don't know us very well, Leo, and we don't know you. Your mother doesn't like us, and she'll break up whatever friendship we might have had. We're too flamboyant for most people. We know that.
And you've met our mother, a nutbag who gets knee-walking drunk."
Her brother interrupted.
"But it's not all her fault. Our mom's had a hard life. Sheba and I weren't born in a rose garden, if you get my drift. When we were little kids, Trevor and I decided to live a world of total make-believe. We got stuck with a bad script. Too much Dracula, not enough Disney."
"You're talking in code," Trevor said to his sister. "As you've pointed out, Leo is one of God's innocents. I think we should let him remain so."
"Might be a little too late for that," Sheba said, winking at me and confirming my earlier intuition, that to Sheba, sex wasn't ruled by notions of love and responsibility and cast about with the shadow of the stations of the cross. To Sheba, sex was, and this was so bizarre that I could hardly fathom it, possibly a matter of fun. I was so astounded by the notion that I ducked my head under water, where I thought even the fish might notice my blush. When I rose to the air and the light, the particular magic of the tide's flow, the slinking sunlight, the turquoise blue of the sky, and the magisterial silence of the marsh had put the twins in a prayer-like trance again. We did not have to move unless we came too near the shore or had to kick away from sandbars. We were tide-carried and tide-possessed. Then Sheba said it again.
"This is it. You're right, Trevor. We're in the middle of it, and it's so nice to recognize it."
"What's it?" I cried out. "You keep talking about it, and I don't know what in the hell either of you are talking about."
Sheba said,
"The perfect moment. Trevor and I have been looking for it our whole lives. We thought we had it before, but something always came along to ruin it."
"Quiet," Trevor remarked.
"Don't jinx it. This all could fall apart on us."
"Last year, we went out whale watching in Oregon. Our mother took us," Sheba said.
"We were just along for the ride, but then the whales started coming.
The ocean seemed full of them. They were migrating north with their babies. Trevor and I looked at each other. We'd been so unhappy. But then we were in the front of the boat, just the two of us. We held hands and looked at each other, then back at the whales, and said, "This is it," at the same time.
"That's before our mother vomited. She said it was seasickness, but we knew it was bourbon," Trevor said. Needless to say, it did not turn out to be the perfect day. Didn't even make the cut for the top 10.
"Leo doesn't need to hear this, Trevor," Sheba said. "He's had a perfect life. He's so innocent."
"Ah, you're new in town," I said. "Have you heard about my brother, Steve?"
"We thought you were an only child," Trevor said.
"I am now. But let me tell you a little story. I had the nicest and best-looking brother in the world, and I thought the happiest. When I was 9, I found him in our bathtub after he'd slit his throat and wrists. I spent the next years talking to shrinks. I thought the sadness would kill me. It almost did. But I'm getting over it."
"Perfect life?
I don't think so, Sheba. And just so you know, I have 0 friends my own age. 0. Both twins reached over and touched me, Trevor grabbing my arm and Sheba my hand.
2,
Sheba said it with emotion.
"You got 2 now," Trevor said. "We can love you twice as well as anyone else because we're twins."
"Have you ever told another teenager about Steve?" Sheba asked. "Not once," I said. "But everyone in Charleston knows about it." Trevor said,
"But we were the ones you chose to tell about it. It's an honor, Leo."
"A great honor," Sheba agreed.
"Let's make room for Steve. Let's invite him to float down the creek with us."
She moved closer to me, and so did Trevor. There was an empty space where my brother should have been.
"Steve,"
I heard Sheba say,
"is that you, sweetheart?" "Of course it's him," Trevor said. "How could he refuse an invitation to this party?"
"I don't see him," I said.
"You've got to feel him,"
Sheba said, a patient instructor.
"We're going to teach you all about the pleasures of make-believe. But you've got to believe in it, too, for us to make it real,"
Trevor said.
"Is it in you, Leo? Then Steve knows it,"
Sheba said quickly.
"He's the one who's really nervous about this meeting. Speak to him."
"Hey, Steve," I said, my voice breaking. "God, I've missed you. No one ever needed a brother more than I did." Then I cracked like a pane of glass, and the twins broke with me. They cried to see me cry as hard as I did. My tears mingled with the salt water of the tides until there were no more tears and all the tides of sorrow had drained the marshes inside me dry. We floated in absolute silence for the next 5 minutes. Then I said, "I ruined your perfect moment."
"No, you didn't,"
Sheba said.
"You added to it. You told us something true about yourself. That never happens."
"You gave us a part of yourself," Trevor said.
"Perfect doesn't just mean happy. Perfect can have lots of different parts."
"Do you know why I brought you to this dock today? Do you know why we're floating toward Charleston Harbor right now?" I asked.
"No,"
Sheba said.
"Does Steve know this story? You've got to include him.
We've taken you into our imaginary world, Leo. You've got to take it seriously." I looked over at the imaginary spot where my brother lived in the running down exit of tides.
"Steve, you're going to love this story most of all."
And I told the story of the summer my mother and father fell in love. The twins listened to the entire story without interrupting me once.
"Now that's a love story," Trevor said finally.
We came out of the creek into the slightly rougher waters of Charleston Harbor, still prisoners of a tide that grew in strength and power once we hit the waters of the Ashley River. The sun was beginning to set, and the river turned citron-colored before it deepened into a full-bodied gold. Panic set in briefly when I did not see Father or any boat. Then I spotted him waving. He had tied the Boston whaler to a buoy and seemed to be fishing with great pleasure, probably in no hurry for us to float into the pickup zone. I think Father was so happy to see me spending time with kids my own age, he might have left us floating until midnight if not for the safety factor. As the tides moved us swiftly toward the rendezvous with my father, I told the twins something I felt I had to tell them, in spite of my resolve to keep it to myself. The day had been so special that I worried about spoiling it, but I didn't think I had much choice. "Sheba, Trevor," I said with great tentativeness, "I don't know how to say this. I've never spent a more wonderful day than today. But just yesterday, a man attacked me. It was in an alleyway. That's how I got this black eye. He put a knife to my throat. He said he would kill me and my parents. He saw us together, Sheba, and knew that you'd spent the night at my house. He wore a mask. He painted one of those things on my face, just like the one on your door. I've never been so scared."
"You just ruined it, Leo," Sheba said coldly. "Ruined the perfect day." "That's it. Puff, gone just like that,"
Trevor said, turning away from me.
"I didn't mean to spoil anything," I said. "I'm worried about you two." "We can take care of each other," Sheba said. "Always have, always will."
My father started the engine and moved out toward the center of the river to meet us. He threw out an anchor, idled the engine, and pulled us aboard one at a time. For several hours, we had floated in the salt water, and now it felt good to dry ourselves with the beach towels and slake our thirst with the iced-down Coca-Cola Father had brought in the coolers. "Your mother drove me out to the plantation. I picked up the car and the clothes you left behind," Father said, as he handed us paper bags full of our summer clothes and flip-flops. In silence, Trevor and I pulled off our bathing trunks and pulled on shorts and t-shirts. I could not have been sorrier that I had mentioned the man in the alley. I thought I had lost the friendship of the twins forever by my indiscretion, though I could not imagine what my real crime consisted of, or why they had both seemed so repulsed by the revelation. From the marina, we crossed Lockwood Boulevard and turned up Sinkler Street, where all of us lived. My father was still delighted and managed to sustain a conversation with both the twins. We walked them to their house, where we could see their mother watching television in the front room. When I told Sheba goodbye, she surprised me by hugging me and kissing me on the cheek.
"It was a perfect day. I'll explain it to Trevor, but it could not have been better."
As she shook my hand, she passed me a note. I hoped it was a love note or a love letter of any kind. I had read about love letters in novels, but never had received one. My father put his arm around my shoulder, and the gesture seemed timely and right. We took our good time, then walked into the house talking about what we'd prepare for dinner that night. As soon as I was alone, I read the note that Sheba had slipped me in secret. It was not the love note I had hoped for, but its shock value was high.
"Dear Leo, sorry about the way Trevor and I acted just now. We knew the man who attacked you. He is the reason we've made up an imaginary life together. The man who hurt you was our father. Yes, Leo. You met our dear old dad."
Chapter 7. Party Time. On the 4th of July, I gave a party to celebrate the end of my probation. All morning, my father and I set up card tables and folding chairs we had commandeered from the high school. Mother decorated each table with a vase of multicolored flowers from her garden. Father had stayed up all night barbecuing a small hog, and he had spent the hours of darkness cursing both the neighborhood raccoons and the untethered dogs driven mad by the aroma of hickory-infused pork. Sheba and Trevor came over in the morning and spent the whole day making themselves useful. They polished the silverware and laid down tablecloths and set immaculate tables all over the backyard, heeding my mother's ironclad order that there would be no plastic knives or forks or paper plates at any social function at her house. When Coach Jefferson and his family arrived just after 1 p.m, he and Father began setting up a makeshift bar. It surprised me that it was going to be a full bar, ranging from the plebeian to the exotic, from iced-down beer to Singapore slings. Mrs. Jefferson and her mother brought huge containers of lemonade and iced tea. Ike and I were sent off to the ice house to buy enough ice to sink an aircraft carrier, according to Father's orders. I took my 57 Chevy, and we headed out toward North Charleston on I-26. We lucked out with the weather. July 4th in Charleston was capable of being hot enough to blister the paint off moving vehicles, but the day was overcast and the breeze a cool one. Though nervous, I also felt a lightness I had not experienced in years, an exhilaration of spirit nearing floodwater marks. I was trying to gain small glimpses of myself that might help me know anything about the man I was in the process of becoming. Ike broke my spell by asking, "Why do you have the top down in this car, white fool?" "Because it's summertime, black dimwit, and the summertime is when it's most fun to ride in a convertible. What do you think it looks like to a white cop or a redneck seeing a white boy and a brother riding down the highway like they own the world? It'll do them some good. Ike, shut up and enjoy the ride." He adjusted his side view mirror. "It'll be my black ass swinging from some rope, from an oak tree. If there's a choice, I sure hope they hang you and not me. They may hang both of us. You don't know the cracker mind like I do." "Oh, really? Who you work for, cracker expert? Mr. Soda, Mr. Ritz, or Mr. Graham? Every time we get together, Ike, every time you've got to turn it into a sociology class. We're going out to buy some ice. Feels like I picked up H. Rapp Brown or Stokely Carmichael hitchhiking along I-26. "Staying aware is staying alive," Ike said. "Let me put you in the trunk." "I like it fine up here. You just need to think about things a little more. That's why I made friends with a sharp guy like you." "You thought about your guest list of this party, white boy?" Ike asked. "You got black people and white people come to the same party, you dumbass son of a bitch." "One black girl I want you to meet," I told him. "She's from the orphanage." "The last thing I want to do is meet an orphan." "You'll like meeting this one. She's awfully pretty." "How you know everything in the world?" "Cracker boy just knows." Then I looked into my rearview mirror and started. "Uh-oh, Ike. Coming up on my left. Pickup truck full of rednecks. Oh, God, they've got shotguns and they're aiming them. Get down. Quick, get down." Ike threw himself to the floorboards. We rode on for 30 seconds. Then Ike asked, "They gone yet?" "I made a mistake. They were kindergarten kids eating snow cones. False alarm." "You lying, white, strong-thumbed son of a bitch," he said, as I pulled the car off a ramp onto Remount Road and drove to a newly opened ice house owned by a man my father once taught. I had rankled Ike with my hoax and was feeling bad about it, but he finally broke a stony silence and said, "You tell any of these white folks today that you invited black folks to your getting out of the loony bin party?" "This party has nothing to do with a loony bin. This is to celebrate my coming off probation." "You sure have led a good life. First a lunatic, then a drug dealer. How did you manage all that?" "I just caught all the breaks, Ike. Just like getting to know you." "No, if the white people get upset at blacks being at the party, they can leave." "Something wrong in your head, white boy," I answered,
But I believe in the power of prayer. Oh, Lord, have me wake up tomorrow thinking just like that wonderful, perfect black hero, Dr. George Washington Carver, Ike Jefferson, goddamn forward-looking junior.
I'll be lucky if you don't get me killed this year, he mumbled, grimacing as I pulled the car onto the loading ramp of the ice house. When Ike and I drove up with both the back seat and the trunk filled with ice, the orphanage school bus was turning the corner on tires as shiny as licorice, with Mr. Lafayette at the wheel. I saw that Sister Polycarp had dressed the orphans in orange jumpsuits with the words St. Jude's Orphanage printed on both the front and the back of the uniform.
Hey, Mr. Lafayette, why did Pollywog make them dress this way?
Didn't you explain this was a party? I asked.
Sister Pollywog doesn't countenance well to advice, Leo, he replied with a snort.
As I made the introductions all around, I could read the humiliation of the three orphans in a form of secret graffiti around their eyes.
Betty Roberts, I said to the new girl I'd met the other day. Here's the guy I told you about, Ike Jefferson. I met him when I was in the state mental hospital.
He did not, Ike said as he shook Betty's hand.
Though I think they made a bad mistake letting this boy out so soon.
There was the nervous laughter of teenagers as I turned to Sheba Poe and asked,
Sheba, you got any extra clothes that Starla and Betty could wear to this party?
Follow me, girls, and I'll fix you right up, Sheba said,
and I could tell she knew exactly what it was I wanted. She took Starla and Betty by the elbows and led them in the direction of her house.
I know some makeup secrets you girls are going to love.
I said, Come on, Niles. You're now going to select something to wear from a real clothes horse's closet. Naturally, I'm referring to me.
I dressed Niles in a new pair of Bermuda shorts, an old pair of Docksiders, and a Citadel t-shirt, of which I owned about 20 because of my father's ox-like affection for his alma mater, plus his painful neediness to see me follow in his footsteps.
You look good, Niles.
I folded his uniform and placed it on my dresser.
Why do you have two beds in your room?
Ike asked as he conducted a brief survey of my bedroom.
I used to have a brother, but he died.
Well, how'd he die?
He killed himself.
Why?
Never got to ask him, I said.
Let's go to the party.
Niles asked, Was he anything like you?
Nah, Steve was just a great guy, I answered.
Nothing like me.
We heard piano music coming from the living room, where I was surprised to find my mother and Trevor Poe performing a duet. Immediately, I could see that my mother's skill as a pianist were overmatched by the far more accomplished Trevor. He had long, perfectly manicured fingernails and beautifully shaped hands. My mother soon held up her own hands in a gesture of surrender.
I give up, Trevor. You didn't tell me you were a prodigy.
It's a God-given gift, Trevor said. Wait until you hear Sheba sing along with me.
She's a singer? My mother asked.
Dr. King, you don't know it yet, but you will. Sheba Poe is a star.
Do you play classical music? My mother asked. When she had abandoned her duet, Trevor had begun to play Hey Jude by the Beatles. But when my mother mentioned classical, he transitioned to a piano arrangement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, his hands flashing with astonishing grace over the keyboard.
Once I hear a song, just once, I can play it for the rest of my life, he explained.
You ever play any football? Ike asked him.
How grotesque! What would be your guess?
The girls returned from the Poe's house across the street, where Sheba had transformed Starla and Betty by applying makeup with a light but expert touch. Both wore sundresses and sandals, and Sheba had even figured out how to disguise Starla's unfortunate strabismus by fitting her with a pair of expensive-looking sunglasses. Starla was a pretty, happy young woman now, and she came up to thank me for giving her up to Sheba.
You and Betty look like you're ready to party. Great job, Sheba!
Some party music, Trevor, I shouted, and Trevor began blasting away at Rock Around the Clock. My party for myself officially began. In the small, insular world I had created for myself in Charleston,
I had invited everyone who had played a significant role in my long struggle to get back to myself. I had experienced a lostness so profound that it seemed like a rainforest, impenetrable and inhospitable, had grown up around me one day. In that dispiriting forest, I had found no relief. But now I planned to leave its alien geography far behind me, and I could feel a child's pleasure every time the doorbell rang and I welcomed Monsignor Max, or Cleo and her husband, or Eugene Haverford, who brought me an afternoon paper. Judge William Alexander and his wife Zan came. It delighted me that they brought my shrink, Jacqueline Criddle. Harrington Cannon walked up the sidewalk. Then came Henry Boleyn with his wife and his two oldest kids. I introduced them to Chad and Fraser Rutledge and Molly Huggy, who came in right behind them.
I'd go out of business without the Rutledge family business, and the Huggy family is just icing on the cake, Henry Boleyn said. So this is where my favorite jailbird lives.
Quiet, Henry, Mrs. Boleyn said, but Henry winked at me.
I tried to get a date for Fraser, Chad said, but not much luck there.
It's great to see you again, Leo, Molly said as we shook hands.
Hey, Fraser, I said. There's a guy I want you to meet. Come with me.
I took her by the hand, led her through the crowd in the backyard, and walked her over to a table where Ike and Betty were chatting with Niles and Starla.
Hey, Niles, I said. This is a friend of mine, Fraser Rutledge, and I thought you two might enjoy each other.
Niles Whitehead.
You seem to be quite the matchmaker, Leo, Starla said.
I don't know. I've never done it before.
Who are you going to match me with? She asked.
I looked around the yard and didn't see an obvious candidate, but my eyes came to rest on Trevor Poe.
Hey, Trevor, will you play some love songs for my friend Starla? I asked.
Trevor said,
I find that prospect divine.
He took Starla back into the house. Then the prettiest music in the world started pouring out of our living room window into the backyard as the tide rose toward us, moon-summoned and spiced with summer. Walking over to a table where Harrington Cannon sat in solitude, I asked,
Want me to get you another drink, Mr. Cannon, or refresh the one you have?
Sit with me for a second, Leo, he said. I have some statements to make to you. Some are general, some provocative.
Sounds like the Harrington Cannon I know and love, I said, pulling a chair up beside him.
Your parents don't own a single item of interest, he said. I've never seen such an awkward display of tastelessness.
They have simple tastes, plus they're teachers, I explained. They couldn't afford much in your store.
You even say that you can't afford to buy anything in your store.
There are people of color here, he said, looking off toward the Ashley River.
Yes, I invited them, I said. They're friends of mine.
I think it is disgraceful to bring colored and white people together for a party. I wouldn't have the first idea of what to say to any of them.
You aren't talking to anyone, white or black. You're sitting by yourself staring at nothing.
I'm admiring a river, he said. God's handiwork at its most superior.
You're being a teensy bit antisocial, I said.
A convicted felon telling me I'm antisocial. I've never heard of such raw presumption.
I made my way across the backyard and greeted some of my favorite customers who stood in line at the barbecue pit. As I made my way toward Judge Alexander's table, my mother called to me from the far side of the yard, where I saw her hugging Septima Clark and her daughter. Septima had been a civil rights leader in Charleston for decades. It was a brave act to invite Septima Clark to any function in Charleston, but it was unheard of for a white family to invite her to a purely social occasion. I felt a shiver of pride as I saw Septima and my mother embrace. I thought that one could entertain doubts about the personas my parents presented to society, but no one could doubt their courage. Monsignor Max rose and led Septima across the yard to eat dinner with him at his table. But the spirit did not pollinate everyone in equal doses. I noticed that Niles and Fraser, Ike and Betty, and Starla Whitehead were on the fringes of Judge Alexander's group, laughing out loud at the stories he offered up in the late afternoon air. Chad Rutledge broke away from Molly when he saw me retracing my steps back toward the judge's table. He got a firm grasp on my arm and led me toward the edge of the lake, where we were all but hidden from view behind a water oak.
"What do you think you're doing, King?" Chad said.
"What are you talking about, Chad?"
"The niggers. You've invited niggers to your party? Are you and your parents nuts?"
"Why don't you go ask my mother and father if they're nuts, Chad, old pal?" I said. "I'd love to see their reaction."
"This is Charleston, son," he informed me.
"Thanks for the news flash."
"We don't do things like that here. We're too smart for that."
"Speak for yourself," I said. "Hey, Chad, this is only the second time I've met you, but smart's not the first word I think of when I think of you."
Chad bristled. "What's the first word you think of, loser? Aren't we having this niggered-up party because you're coming off probation?
Poor Molly and I got caught snorting a little coke, but they found enough in your cheap sports coat to get half the city high."
"I screwed up, Chad. So far it's been the story of my life." "So what's the first word you think of when you think of me?"
"My mother taught me not to talk in clichés. It offends the English teacher part of her."
"Give me a try. I don't mind clichés," he said.
"The first word that comes to mind is this.
Asshole."
"Yep, that's it, all right. The second is flaming asshole. The third is flaming fucking asshole. That about sums it up, Chad. Need anything else?"
"One thing. Why did you set my sister up with a fucking orphan?"
"Well, you teased her about not having any dates at the yacht club. You made fun of the way she looked. I thought she was pretty and very nice. I'd just met Niles, and he looked like he could use a friend or two. They seemed to like being with each other tonight."
"I'll guarantee you it'll be the last time you see them together," Chad said. "My parents will go nuts when they hear about little orphan Annie."
"I imagine so," I said. "But I'll bet Fraser and Niles will have something to say to that."
"You don't know a thing about how the Charleston aristocracy thinks or works."
"But I've watched people a lot. They look pretty easy to predict."
"I'm leaving this party," Chad said. "And I'm taking Fraser and Molly with me."
"God, it was such a pleasure getting to know you, Chad," I said, not bothering to hide the mockery in my voice. "Don't go out for football, pal. A warning."
"You think I'm afraid of you?"
"You should be," I said, "because I plan to knock you on your pussy Charleston aristocratic South Abroad ass."
"You and your niggers?"
"Yep, me and all the rest."
"Keep your mountain nigger away from my sister," Chad warned.
"Who?"
"The orphan. He's out of the mountains of North Carolina, so he's a mountain nigger. Pure white trash, which is lower than a nigger."
"Bye-bye, Chad," I said. "What a swell guy. You make me even hate white people." Chad stormed away, and I wandered through the yard, offering more helpings of barbecue and fried fish, and calming myself down. Chad seemed both venomous and insecure, a flammable combination. I pulled a chair up to Judge Alexander to hear him ending a tall tale to laughter and applause, because it seemed mannerly, what a good host should do. But my peripheral vision caught a serious argument being conducted in a whispered fever at the side of the house, where my mother's prized camellias grew to unseemly heights. Chad and Fraser Rutledge were locked like dissonant enemies in one of those battles that often spring most violently between people who are supposed to love each other. One fact I was sure of was that Fraser was giving no quarter, nor taking a foot-long hot dog's ration of shit from her brother. From a distance of 20 feet, I watched Niles and Starla witnessing the dispute, and I was sure they knew where the heart of the argument lay. I wondered how long these orphans had felt humiliation at the hands of the native-born citizens of towns where they would always be dishonored visitors. Fraser broke away from her brother's grip, and when he tried to prevent her from going back to Niles, I saw the exact moment
when the leading rebounder among South Carolina high school women basketball players shot a well-placed elbow into her brother's ribs and sent him flying into a 10-foot camellia bush.